Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. If you're an archaeologist, the place you work is called a dig. And it's called that for obvious reasons, because the archaeologist's job is to expose the past, layer by layer, deeper and deeper. What's not so obvious is that astronomers are doing the same kind of work. Instead of shovels and trowels and brushes, they use their telescopes, gradually peeling back the story of the universe. They can do this because it takes time for light to reach us from distant locations in space. So the farther back into space astronomers look, the farther back in time they see. Astronomers like this one.
I'm Garth Illingworth, professor of astronomy at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and I'm also an astronomer at UCO Lick Observatory.
You could say Garth Illingworth is a bit like the Lewis Leakey of astronomy. He's digging deep into our cosmic past in an effort to understand where we came from.
When we need to look back 13 billion years, and just to put this in context, the universe itself is 13.7 billion years old. So now we're asking our telescopes and our data processing, our capabilities to take us all the way back to 13 billion years or 700 million years from the Big Bang. And to do that is extraordinarily difficult.
Of course, astronomers have always been trying to dig deeper, looking at more distant objects to understand earlier stages in cosmic history. But now, for the first time, they're acquiring the tools to see the first chapter, when the stars and galaxies that make up the universe we know today first came into existence.
The importance of this period is that it's when the seeds of all the galaxies today were put in place. That, in fact, that actually goes back to almost the beginning of time itself.
.7 billion years ago, the Big Bang happened. No one knows why, but it left us with a universe that was expanding rapidly and full of matter and energy. The matter came in two varieties: ordinary matter, which can shine when it's hot, and dark matter, which doesn't give off light at all. The ordinary matter mostly forms hydrogen gas and will one day become stars and galaxies, and us. But to do that, it needs the dark matter. There's more dark matter and it's more massive, so as the universe evolves, the dark matter starts to clump up under the pull of its own gravity, and it pulls the ordinary matter along with it.
And it wasn't until probably 200 million years after the Big Bang that some of the very first stars started to form in some of the denser clumps of dark matter. And these stars formed from the gas that was in that dark matter clumpy region.
Garth Illingworth and his colleagues want to see what happens next, when the first small galaxies appear on the scene. To do that, they need a new tool. Actually, a retool, in the form of a newly refurbished Hubble Space Telescope.
And Houston, we're seeing the band at the edge now. How's that look?
Can you go back to the right?
And Houston, that looks better.
When astronauts journeyed to the space telescope last year, they had their work cut out for them, changing batteries and gyroscopes, making all sorts of repairs to extend the 20-year flight of the Hubble well into the next decade. But they also added a new wide-field camera that can take more penetrating shots of the deep universe than ever before.
So we expected that we would be able to do great things with the camera, but we were awaiting the astronauts to do this. And then when they went up and they put it in and it looked to be successful, it was turned on, it was clearly working.
I understand that if it breaks, then wide field stays in.
What John said is correct.
And we all thought this was going to be very exciting. In fact, it was even more exciting than we realized.
One of the key features of the new camera is that it can see in infrared light. That's a longer wavelength of light than the human eye can see, which turns out to be a very useful feature when you're looking deep into the universe's history.
As you look back in time, you're looking at light which is now redshifted. Astronomers talk about this term, which just means that the light that originates in the galaxy in one part of the spectrum is actually moved out to a redder part of the spectrum. And it turns out when we are trying to see these very early 13-billion-year-old galaxies, the light they emit is in the ultraviolet, but now it's shifted right across the optical and into the near-infrared region of the spectrum.
But even in infrared light, the task of catching some of the earliest galaxies ever seen is not easy. These are among the dimmest, most remote objects ever witnessed. Just to see anything at all means pointing the Hubble in one direction and staring for a long, long time.
If you take a camera and do an exposure, you might do a hundredth of a second. Here with our telescope, we do days and we do weeks of exposure to actually see these objects. And that's with Hubble, which is the best imaging telescope that we have these days.
By August of last year, Hubble was ready to start staring into space. For 4 days, it was pointed at one spot, gradually gathering up the sparse light coming from some of the farthest objects anyone has ever tried to see before.
The region of the sky that we stared at was Fornax, and the reason that we chose that was that the deepest ever optical image in the universe that had ever been taken was taken in this part of the sky 5 years ago. And we, of course, wanted to capitalize on that, and so we placed this new image in the infrared on top of the older, extremely deep optical image. And so that set the region of the sky, and it's tiny, by the way. This region is only about 1% the size of the full moon.
But the data was public, meaning other teams could also take up the hunt.
Unfortunately, we knew that we had a lot of competition. Two other groups were working on this. And so within 1 week, working nights and days, we managed to put together a paper and submit it to the journal. And then within 2 days, they also did it too. So we realized that we really did have the competition.
And then came the moment of truth, the first image of a universe only 700 million years old.
We had expected that we would find objects that we couldn't find before. And when we got the data and we started to work through it, we realized the data was even better quality than we expected. And so we got extremely enthusiastic. We put it all together to make one extremely deep image, and we just went, wow, this is incredibly deep.
The team then pored over the images, looking for tiny galaxies measuring about 1/20th the size of our own Milky Way.
They really just look like fuzzy little blobs. If anybody's looked at a magnified picture and seen a few pixels in there of some spot of dust or something, you know, within a photograph or with an image, that's what these look like, just a bunch of pixels, not very many of them.
Illingworth knew how to dig for the most distant galaxies because they're the most redshifted, and that means they have no counterpart in the optical image that was taken previously. But what would we see if we could travel back to one of these primitive baby galaxies?
Looking out, we would be surrounded by very blue stars. There'd be lots of nebula, so very vivid nebula, I think, would be very bright around us, especially if we took a small telescope and looked around. So looking up at the night sky would not be like looking at the Milky Way. It would be much more like being in a region where there's lots of action going on with hot gas and stars and very blue, bright stars.
So that was then, a time when galaxies were small and the stars were mostly blue. But how do we get from those early galaxies to something like the Milky Way?
Galaxies collide violently. They come together, they stick together, and they make the next step in a bigger galaxy. They form more stars when they do that because the gas crashes together and forms stars in there. And then a little while later, another galaxy will come by and they will merge again. They will collide. And so it's this build-up through these violent processes, step by step through the life of the universe to get us to the Milky Way.
And somewhere in that step-by-step process, the stars were also churning out the raw materials of life, carbon, oxygen, and the trace metals that we all depend on for our existence. What's intriguing is that the quest to dig deeper has also revealed that the preconditions for life got underway quickly in our universe.
We are surprised in the more massive galaxies we see 500 million years later than these early galaxies that we're seeing. They appear to have more metals. So the build-up of the elements happens quite quickly. And so maybe within 1 or 2 billion years, there might be planetary systems on which life could start to form. And so there could well have been life forming at a very much earlier stage than on our Earth.
We've been listening to Garth Illingworth talk about using the Hubble Space Telescope to acquire the deepest views of galaxies in the early universe so far. But the quest isn't over, because astronomers are still hoping to look even deeper, to when the first galaxies and even the first stars began to emerge from the primordial gas that filled the universe in the aftermath of the Big Bang. To do that, they're going to need even bigger telescopes, both in space and on the ground. And here to talk about that is Dr. Roberto Abraham, an astronomer here at the University of Toronto. Roberto Abraham, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to The Universe in Mind.
You are very welcome. My pleasure.
So, Roberto, we've been looking at this idea of looking deeper and deeper into the universe, seeing earlier and earlier epochs in the universe's history. What's the motivation for you to try to be looking as far as you can possibly see?
So me, personally, I think it's a frustration at not being able to be a great explorer.
Huh.
You know what I mean? It's Earth's surface, at least, is fairly well mapped. You know, it's not true for the oceans. But I was always inspired when I was growing up by the great explorers, you know, Columbus and Magellan. And this just kind of seems to be the logical trajectory for that kind of unfulfilled ambition, right? Is to explore the universe on its vastest scale, to scratch that exploration itch inside of me.
So, Roberto, I think we should give our listeners a sense of the landscape. We're looking further back in space to see further back in time. What do astronomers think was going on when the universe was that much younger? You know, in other words, what's the chronology of events that you're trying to back your way into?
Okay, so the universe is created 13.7 billion years ago in the Big Bang. And then there's a whole lot of nothing, all right, until the formation of the first stars and galaxies a few hundred million years after that. So the universe created by the Big Bang is actually kind of a simple universe. It's just hydrogen and helium. And the problem is that taking that hydrogen and helium and getting it to collapse on scales that forms galaxies and stars requires a change, okay? So what happened a couple hundred million years after the Big Bang is the universe was blasted with energy that changed the neutral hydrogen and helium into a hydrogen and helium plasma, which is the stuff that we know will collapse to form stars and galaxies. And that that blast of energy, okay, is something that we have dubbed first light, just because we're completely ignorant, and when we're completely ignorant, we like to give stuff names, okay? It makes us feel a little better.
Right.
Okay, so first light occurred. It may well have been, the formation of some, the first generation of supermassive stars that somehow formed through some physics that we don't understand. It may be material streaming into the early generation of black holes somehow created by the Big Bang through some process we don't understand. It may be some subatomic particle decaying, which we don't understand. But something happened, okay? And so that then set in motion a series of events that ultimately led to me and you having this interview.
Right.
Okay? It basically was, you know, the first push that led to the universe becoming the complex, rich universe you see around you.
And as you say, it seems like there are a lot of open questions as to exactly what happened then.
Oh, completely. I mean, it's actually a glorious time for this field, because we're well aware of all of this stuff, which we don't understand, but which we know happened, and we know roughly when it happened, which is the key to actually, you know, learning stuff in astronomy. Astronomers are simple-minded folk in a lot of ways, right? We have one trick, and our trick is basically you build a telescope that lets you look back in time and you see stuff happening before your eyes, right? And so the trick is you got to know what bit of time to look at. And for the last, you know, few decades, we've known that something like this must have happened, but we didn't really know when. And the big advance over the last 10 years is now we can kind of localize what time in the history of the universe do you have to focus on in order to see this rise of complexity begin to occur.
And what is that target time?
Order of magnitude, it's like 500 million years after the Big Bang.
So if we use an archaeological metaphor, which is something we've been talking about in the show, if you dig deeper and deeper, that first layer, that foundational layer, is somewhere around 500 million years after the Big Bang.
Yeah, although, so the archaeological metaphor, while a fine one, it's not my favorite one, because I actually think A cool thing about being an astronomer is you don't have to live like those archaeologists digging up them bones, right? If I want to see a dinosaur walking around, I don't have to infer it from some bones and then in my head or my computer reconstruct this thing walking around. I can just see the thing walking around, at least in a statistical sense, by having that telescope, which is big enough to let me look far enough back in time, and I see that dinosaur doing its thing.
Witnessing the past before your eyes.
Right. And so it's a wonderful gift, okay, that astronomy can pull off that is pretty much unique in terms of all of the other sciences. So I think we should play that card over and over because it's, you know, the magic thing that we can do that the other sciences really can't.
So as you say, that card depends, or that trick depends, on a piece of technology, which is a telescope that can look that far back. What is the challenge in doing it? Why is it so hard to make a telescope that will be able to show you that epoch?
Well, you know, every age, I presume, has its own set of challenges. The ones we face are we now need to look so far back in time that most of the interesting things you want to look at are now shifted into the infrared. Okay, and the infrared is kind of a tricky wavelength range because it's not great getting stuff through Earth's atmosphere in the infrared. That's the first problem. The next problem is that the detectors of this infrared light are sensitive to their own radiation, right? So you have to cool it all, you know, to a really cold temperature. And also they're expensive. So the next bad thing is that, you know, as you take these things and you put them far away, they're pretty small and they're pretty faint. Okay, so them being pretty small means that really you have to come up with a way of defeating the blurring of Earth's atmosphere, right? So you can either put it, you know, in space so that there's no atmosphere to worry about, mm-hmm. or you can come up with some fancy adaptive optics technology that lets you deal with that. And the fact that these things are faint means you need a pretty big telescope.
It seems like things are moving on two fronts. Right now, we've been hearing about what the Hubble can do now that it's been serviced and has a new camera that can get closer to that zone, at least 700 million years after the Big Bang. But space telescopes aren't huge compared to what's available on the ground. So which is the better way to see those really distant galaxies?
My suspicion is that what you want is both things. I don't mean to seem like the greedy astronomer trying to grasp, you know, all of the money to build everything. But it just does seem like you need the ground-based telescopes for certain things in order to, you know, the huge light blast from the enormous mirrors is required in order to take a really good spectra of things. And on the other hand, you want something like the James Webb Space Telescope to actually detect things to tell me where to point my enormous ground-based telescope.
Right.
And it's also true that, you know, this adaptive optics technology is not magic, right? It's limited. There's certain things you can do with it and certain things we know right now, at least with, you know, any technology within the next 10 years, we're not going to be doing with it. And so it's not a panacea. So you really need both things, I think, in mm-hmm. order to have a, you know, a strategy that's almost certainly going to work.
Okay, so let's talk about the James Webb Space Telescope, because that's coming up in 2014, so that might be sort of the first serious shot. Although, as you say, the combination of technologies in the end is probably what's going to really open up this domain. So how does that work? Once James Webb is up there, is it a matter of looking for long periods of time, or, you know, exactly what are you hoping to see?
A good question. And so we're, you know, groups of us are sitting around in rooms right now scratching our heads trying to devise the right strategy for this. And it's just not obvious. The reason is we don't know what the sources of first light actually are, right? So depending on what these things actually are, you would approach the problem in different ways. And so there are certain strategies where, you know, you say the sources of first light are these ultra-massive stars, much more massive than any star in the current universe, collected together in clumps in galaxies, in which case you go, aha, I will use JWST NIRCam to find these things and then follow them up with NIRSpec. And so that's, you know, strategy A. Mm-hmm. But then it could be, you know, some weird decaying elementary particle that is not happening in a localized supermassive star, in which case the source of light is extended. And then you go, aha, I will use the Canadian-built tunable filter imager in order to find these things. It also depends on how clustered these sources of first light are. If they're mm-hmm. super clustered, you would really want lots of area. So you don't want to go super deep with JWST. You want to, you know, collect a lot of area in the sky. You know, the converse, though, is in certain scenarios, what you want to do is integrate forever in just one tiny little portion of the sky.
Right.
And it's a tricky thing, right? Because we have to decide now-ish what we're going to do. Because in the world of NASA, nothing gets decided really at the last minute, right?
Right.
So we got to decide in the next year or two how to do this. But the right thing to do is not known. So anyway, this is a long a dissembling way of telling you nobody knows, okay? Nobody knows the right way to use JWST in order to do this. But JWST was constructed with this kind of ignorance in mind. So its suite of instruments is carefully balanced so that one of these things ought to do the job. But which one of them is going to do the job, we don't know.
And I certainly get the impression that, I mean, this is the kind of discovery that isn't like finding a new continent on the horizon, but it'll actually take time to even understand if you are seeing the first light.
There, I don't know. It might actually smack you in the face and say, here I am. You know, if we can find something that has a clear signature of just being pure hydrogen and helium, and its redshift is such that we know it's, you know, right in the appropriate time range, then I think you could, you know, wave a flag and say we found it. On the other hand, it may be one of these things that's kind of thoughtful and methodical, and you have to actually argue on the basis of, you know, statistics that you've actually detected this weak signal. So it's hard to know. I mean, that's part of the coolness and the fun of this, right, is that we know it happened. We have no idea what it is that happened. And so it's this huge, mysterious set of possibilities, and, you know, you roll the dice and you pick one. But ultimately, I have no idea how the universe chose to do this, and that's the whole purpose of building this telescope, is to find out.
It must really charge you up to think, you know, because up till now, there's been this progression in astronomy. You know, it's been 400 years, bigger and bigger telescopes looking further and further. But in a sense, you're kind of getting towards the end of the story, that, you know, maybe seeing as far as it's possible to see in this coming generation. Is that sort of a profound thing to think?
Yeah, so some days I think, man, that's profound. We're hitting the wall, right? But on other days I go, nah, it's just hubris, right?
Right.
Somebody's going to come up with, you know, a gravity wave telescope that's going to even be able to push beyond the cosmic microwave background. And we're going to keep, you know, this, I see no end in sight to our ability to look further and further back into the history of the universe. And the universe's physics is kind of almost, without getting too technical, it's kind of logarithmic, right? Which means as you go further and further back, there's more and more stuff going on, even though the period of time in which it can happen is smaller, because the energy range over which the universe is doing stuff gets so huge. So there's a lot of cool things that are going to be out there to discover, you know, beyond the even the wall of the cosmic microwave background. And there's tons of wavelength space that is totally unexplored, right? So JWST has carved off an important piece of the problem and will be fantastic for learning about this specific thing. But then we're going to find, for every question it answers, it's going to give us another 10 little baby questions. And some of those are going to turn out to be completely profound and fundamental. And we're going to continue on this roller coaster ride, I think, indefinitely.
Well, Roberto Abraham, we've certainly been very lucky to be with you for this tiny part of the journey. And we're certainly looking forward to hearing more. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Evan.
That's it for this episode of The Universe in Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is sponsored by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Toronto. Johannes Hearn is associate producer of our show, with online support from Kathy Parrott. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget. I'm Ivan Semenik. Join us again soon for more excursions into the realm of astronomical ideas. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind.